Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 122 on Friday, November 19, 2010. Darlene and I are back in Cambridge, Massachusetts after our adventures in South Africa and Botswana for the last 3 weeks or so. We had a fantastic time, and if you're interested in what we saw, you can check out the photos and writing that I posted at my blog, which is lenedgerly.com. And that was provided a break from preparing weekly podcast episodes because I'd put three episodes in the can before I left. So this is the first chance to get back to a sort of live podcasting. I was looking forward to an interview yesterday, which was set up while I was on the trip, with a top Amazon executive so that we could look back on exactly 3 years since the launch of the original Kindle on November 19, 2007. Unfortunately, a schedule conflict arose in Seattle, and I'm hoping that that interview will take place sometime in the next few weeks instead. In signing up a guest on short notice, I ended up connecting with Peter Hildick-Smith, a publishing industry analyst who is scared to death by the Kindle's success. So we're going to note the anniversary of the Kindle's launch with an articulate but contrarian, at least for this podcast, point of view about what the Kindle hath wrought and what's ahead.
We're not seeing more people reading. We're seeing heavy readers reading more. We're not seeing increased revenue for publishers, which means authors have less of an ability to make a living.
In news, Amazon today made it possible to give the gift of Kindle titles in time for Christmas shopping. Barnes & Noble begins shipping its new Nook Color device, which will clearly be competing with the Kindle. And I'll have some thoughts about an interview that Jeff Bezos did 3 years ago today at the launch of the Kindle. That was with the interview, his first of a series of Kindle interviews he's done with Charlie Rose. For the tech tip, I'm going to tell you a way to find things on your Kindle that will save at least one keystroke. In content, I'm going to pass along a listener named Mark's list of 383 great authors, as well as tell you about a video review by Nick Todd of a, in some ways, disappointing Kindle version of a really great true life spy story. First up in news, Amazon today made it possible for the first time to give a Kindle book to anyone who has an email address. If you look near the Buy Now with One Click button next to any Kindle title on the Amazon.com site in the Kindle section, you will now see another button labeled Give as Gift. If you click on that, you'll be asked to enter your Amazon password, and that brings up a screen where you'll have a to field where you can enter an email address. You can change how your name appears in the from field, and then there's a space for a message. You can preview the email that will be sent and then click on place your order. The page says the email will typically be delivered to the recipient within 5 minutes, but when I tried this between Darlene's Amazon account and mine, I sent I had her send me a gift after asking her permission first, of course, but there was a book on my wish list that I chose to do this, and that was a good 5 hours ago, and it hasn't shown up yet in my email telling me that I have had a gift given to me. So maybe they've got some first day glitches in this, which will be worked out later. I also noticed in the Me and My Kindle blog that this feature apparently doesn't exist if you are purchasing a book from your Kindle itself. The button appears only if you are working off the website. I was telling Darlene about this earlier today and wondering, you know, at first it looks great. I think this is a great new functionality. But in thinking about whether I would actually use this to give Kindle books to some of the people in my family that have Kindles, one thing is it doesn't seem to have something that you can print out that says, I've sent this book to your Kindle. And then it doesn't seem to let you, for example, have the book show up in the Kindle on December 25th or on the date of a birthday. So maybe there'll be some more functionality that gets added to this, but I think it's a great thing to be able to do. I was also talking to Darlene about, you know, it's one thing to give a physical book to somebody because you can wrap it up and it's really a thing. if I'm going to give someone a specific Kindle book, why wouldn't I just give them an equal amount of gift card on Amazon so that they could buy whatever book they want on their Kindle? She didn't seem to think that was an issue, that this would be a good way to give gifts. And you know, when you start comparing the gift giving process of a physical book versus a Kindle, it's just sort of a whole new area. So it's going to be fun to see how it goes. But I have a hunch this is going to result in a lot more sales of Kindle titles, and that it's a good bit of functionality that Amazon put out there today. Apparently, just a day or two, I missed this, but Kobo, the Borders e-reader, they had recently announced a similar capability that was going to come out early in December, and Amazon sort of beat them to the punch. But I'm sure that they didn't go home and invent this just because they heard about Kobo. It was probably in the works, and they were probably glad to have this announcement preempt some of whatever buzz was going to accrue to Kobo. Second item in news, the Nook Color is shipping. I saw one at the Harvard Coop that was on display. It's an attractive device. It's pretty much a hybrid between what we think of as an e-reader, like the Kindle or the previous Nook, all of the e-readers with e-ink screens. From reviews that I've seen in Engadget and elsewhere, it really does straddle the categories, because it's got an LCD screen, it's a little larger, it's got a 7-inch diagonal screen, it looks like it weighs at least twice as much as the Kindle 3, and it costs $249 compared to $139 for the Kindle Wi-Fi and $189 for the 3G. So I'm looking forward to the one that I pre-ordered from Africa when I was traveling. Should be here in any day now, and I'll be putting up a video to give my first impressions of it. And it's always great to see a new device land in this space and to see what it does well, what it doesn't. And I'll be passing that along probably on the readingedge.com podcast, where I put most of my video reviews, especially when they're of products other than the Kindle itself. Third in news, since today is the 3-year anniversary of the introduction of the original Kindle on Monday, November 19th, 2007, I thought it'd be a good day to go back and listen to Charlie Rose's interview that evening, I think, with Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. It's really fun to listen to. I mean, Bezos is practically jumping out of his chair with enthusiasm for the Kindle, and Charlie Rose has got one, and he's holding it as if it's some kind of a totally new creation. But what I was struck by is how much of what is still true about the Kindle was totally within Bezos's frame of mind 3 years ago. He talked about it as a purpose-built device. He said that color might arrive in 3 to 5 years. He'd seen it in the lab, but it wasn't ready yet. And he had his rap about the book disappearing and the way that was the key aspect of the book when they went through the design process. Also some nice bits about Charlie Rose and Jeff Bezos's love of reading stretching back to childhood. So here's a couple of clips from the interview, and I'll have a link to it so that if you'd like to go back and listen to it as a way to celebrate the third anniversary of the Kindle, it's pretty good listening, and it's a video, so on your computer you'll be able to watch it.
The modern book arrived via the Gutenberg press in the 1430s. It has remained relatively unaltered for more than five centuries. Now Jeff Bezos aims to change this with the help of the company he founded and remains CEO of, Amazon.com. This morning, his company launched the Kindle, a new device for reading digital books that Newsweek calls the iPod of reading.
In this next clip, I don't know if Bezos is being disingenuous in talking about how excited the publishers were about the Kindle 3 years ago or in the development process, but when you remember the recent history with the Apple V publishers, Macmillan and all, who forced the agency model onto Amazon as a way to keep the Kindle prices higher than Amazon wanted them to be, This sounds like a fairly rose-colored view of the publisher's reaction to the Kindle.
We've gotten great cooperation from publishers. They've embraced this.
I think all of them?
All the major publishers are in here, and actually, I think, you know, most of the small publishers as well, but all the major publishers are in here, without exception. And I think that what they see, part of it is when they saw this device, because they've seen the landscape of previous devices and that they haven't worked very well, but I think when they saw this device, they got excited about it.
Well, that may well be. They may have gotten excited about it, and then they might have gotten scared about it. And we'll see a little bit more of that latter feeling about the Kindle in the interview. I received an email with a tech tip in it when I was in Africa, and it came from Carl Wiebgen. That's W-E-I-B-G-E-N. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Wiebgen or Wiebgen. And he lives in Australia in Bendigo, Victoria. He wrote, "I have a tech tip you may have already used, but I was told this one by a fellow Kindle user this week. From your homepage, you can search for books by typing the term to search, e.g. press home, then type Dracula, his example. Pressing the Enter/OK button will find all titles or books with the word in their text." Now, I thought, well, this is something I already know about, but actually the tip which Carl has passed along here does save one keystroke from how I normally would look for a search term from the homepage. So in other words, if you type a search term from your homepage and the letters just appear down at the bottom, the natural thing to do at that point is to use the five-way controller to go one click over to the right so you highlight search my items. But what Carl's friend pointed out is that without moving that cursor over to search my items, if you press either the return button, which is the one just below the delete key, or if you press the center of the selection pad, the little dot, in either case, you're going to activate that search for your term, and the Kindle will show you all of the items on your Kindle which contain that term. And then if you you highlight any one of the individual book titles, then you'll see specific instances which you can scroll through and go to parts in the text which have the term. So, you know, sometimes these tricks which save just one or two keystrokes, especially if it's something that you do over and over, they really are quite handy. And I love getting tips like this from listeners that save me a little time, and I'm glad to pass them along. So if you've got something that you've learned to do with your Kindle that makes using it more useful or faster or easier or just more fun, I hope you'll consider sending me an email, and you can send that to podchronicles@gmail.com. And thank you to Carl from Australia. When I got your email, I was actually a lot closer to you in South Africa than I am now in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter Hildick-Smith is the president and founder of Codex Group, the first book audience research company. Codex provides publishers, authors, and agents with insights into what book readers are thinking, doing, and wanting, as well as how people shop for books. To do this, Peter's group tests books, book ideas, and book communications to help get a book's message across more effectively. When he launched his company in 2004, the e-book sector was embryonic, though visible enough for digital rights to start being included in book contracts. He said that practice dated back to 1994. Now that e-books have come into their own, the book screens which Codex does for its clients identify all the different ways a potential reader might encounter a new title.
We ask people, do you want to buy it now in ebook? Do you want to buy it now in hardcover? Do you want to wait a year and get it in paperback? Do you want to just borrow it from the library, or you're not interested at all? So, you know, every book has a different dimension. Some books that are perhaps more politically in your face, people want to buy now in hardcover because they want to show people it's their badge of what they believe and what they're supporting. Other books are much more, wait, get it in paperback, or I'll get it now in ebook. It really varies. Each book is got a completely different sort of spectrum of interest and format and time and price.
Can you see any similarities or make any generalities about the type of book that tends to show up pretty strongly as one that people are going to want in ebook format as opposed to the other windows?
Well, I can tell you categorically from the major publishers that we work with, there are two things that they're seeing. And there was an article in Publishers Weekly that revealed some of this information about 2 weeks ago. But the big high visibility blockbuster titles tend to get a very high level of Kindle purchase. But what's not happening as much with Kindle purchases are nonfiction purchases and purchases of newer authors, debut works, less widely promoted works. And so you've got a huge skew to the big high visibility titles, and everything else really kind of falls by the board. Not necessarily just fiction, but, you know, for example, you know, President Bush's new book, I believe that has a very high percent of ebook buying as well. But things that are less prominent on the sort of wider, you know, media agenda, if you will.
Any idea what percent of the books sold on the Bush memoir yet have gone ebook as opposed to print?
I'm not sure, but I'm guessing it's probably between 20% and 30%. 30% seems to be about the highest right now. That's what the Grisham did in its first week on sale. It was reported in the Wall Street Journal by Jeff Trachtenberg. That seems to be about the highest level. When Amazon reported back earlier in the summer they were selling more ebooks than hardcover, we talked to some of our other research colleagues. We talked to Publishers Weekly. Our data wasn't quite supporting that. There's no question that Kindle buyers are buying more ebooks than hardcover, although they do still buy in print, absolutely. We then polled many of the big houses, and that was the basic conclusion, is that the big books are getting a lot of ebook traction. The smaller books, the debut works, aren't appearing hardly at all. Now, the irony of this is if you look at Kindle buyers back from November of 2007, we've been tracking them since the launch, what you saw initially were a group of 55 to 64-year-olds as the primary group of Kindle owners. Reading rates continue up to about age 75. So you've got the combination of people who are very active readers with a very high disposable income. And so that was the first tranche of Kindle owners. If you look at the kinds of authors they like to read, the kinds of authors that they respect, they're a much more sophisticated group of readers. They will give literary fiction authors who are not perhaps as widely read a much higher rating than the average book shopper will. So you've got a very sophisticated population, but the strange thing is when you put the Kindle in their hands, it's like you put the blinders on, and they're not seeing the diversity anymore. They're not seeing the range. And there's something like around 30 million different books available on Amazon. It's a staggeringly high number, and if you look at it on a day-to-day basis, it's growing at a very rapid rate. So, you know, they've got this wealth of opportunity, but for some reason, and I'll get to the reason in a moment, they're not aware of this diversity of books. They tend to be more shopping bestseller lists. They tend to be shopping, you know, what's hot lists and things like that. They're not exploring and discovering the diversity of books that they were in their pre-Kindle phase, is what seems to be going on. And we're actually working on a research project on that right now.
What are your theories? What's your hunch? Why is that happening?
Well, the reason that's happening is you need three things to sell a book. You need discovery. Does the book exist? Do I know it's there? You need conversion. In other words, when you know it's there and you've sort of browsed it and done what you like to do to determine if you want to buy a book, does it interest you enough to want to buy it? And then it's got to be available. So discovery, conversion, and availability. The difficulty seems to be with shopping in the Kindle world is your ability to discover things is kind of hampered. You don't discover as many new books in a digital shopping mode as you do when you're going to bookstores. So if you ask people where they learned about the book they bought last, even among iPad owners, who I would view as the most digitally, you know, focused, the single largest source of new book discovery is still bookstores, at about twice the rate of ebook stores. And so when you get a Kindle, you tend to be in the stores a lot less, and that form of unfettered discovery that you get in a store where you're just, you know, confronted with literally hundreds of books at once, doesn't really exist. Browsing digitally is a much more linear experience. So it's click to click to click to click. Whereas, you know, if you think about the bookstore, it's kind of the ultimate broadband experience. You're able to process and see, you know, a tremendous number of content in a very short period of time. And so that seems to be what's going on, is when you're in a pure digital space, you don't have the ability to, you know, reach out into what's called the long tail, you know, all those 29.9 million books out there that aren't going to be on a top list or a trend list or a bestseller list. So it's constraining what people can find and discover.
Well, that's fascinating. You know, my own experience, I'm not sure it runs counter to that, but I find myself finding books that I wouldn't have found in a bookstore. And an example was, my wife and I were just in Africa for 3 weeks. And so I took my Kindle and I did a simple search on Amazon for South Africa fiction. And I came up with a Booker Prize winner and three fantastic novels set in Johannesburg. One was following a homeless kid, and another was sort of a violent murder mystery in Cape Town. Same thing when I got to Botswana. I found some terrific books that totally informed my experience while I was there on the trip. But and the other thing that I find is that I find out about books from the New York Times Book Review and Sam Tannenhaus's podcast, and as a literate, someone who's really interested in literature, I don't have the sense that I'm not finding books just because I'm spending less time in bookstores, because there's so many other ways that news of a new author can find me, and then the ease of hitting buy on the Kindle makes it that much easier to go there.
Yeah, no, I mean, people are finding books in myriad ways, whether they're Kindle owners or not. It's just statistically, that's the largest single source. And, you know, for every book, there's a genesis point where people become aware of it. And when you're going into a store or to the Kindle store saying, I need books on South Africa, it's more of a planned purchase. You know you're looking for something specific. I'm talking about sort of unfettered browsing.
Where I see.
You get into crossover readings. Oh, boy, there's a book I never would have. Most people tend to read in about four or five categories generally. That's their sort of their sweet spot. So, you know, I only read, you know, lit fiction, historical fiction, you know, biography and science, let's say. So people tend to be within their world. Once in a while, they cross over into other areas, but, you know, they will only find out or be open to investigating those if they have a sort of a chance encounter. And it can come through any way. It can come through, you know, television interviews. It can come through, you name it.
Yeah.
And we track those. I mean, the last study we did in June, we asked, we had 7,561 people who told us, what book did you buy last? Where'd you learn about it? Why'd you buy it? And so we literally went through all 7,561 books to look at where those books were first learned about. And then we compared Kindle owners, iPad owners, and non-device owners to see what the differences were. So now, that's what the numbers show.
I see. So you're doing some pretty serious research to come to these conclusions.
Yeah, we do very large sample studies. So the one we just finished last week, we have about 6,250. So we're just digging into that data right now.
Now, on those surveys, say your June one with the 7,561 and the more recent one, are you seeing this figure of 9 to 10% of books are being purchased in ebook, or does your data break out that number?
We don't. Let's see. That's probably the best. I mean, that's the number that's coming from the publishers right now. So I really I've got to defer to them, because they've actually got the full unit profile there. And you know, again, it varies title to title.
Right.
And so, you know, they're looking at across the full range of all possible categories and books.
Yeah. As you look ahead on behalf of your clients, are you expecting that to rise to 50% in the next 5 to 10 years? Or what sort of a growth trend do you think the ebook sector is going to be on?
Well, right now, with all the new activity back in July and since then, with Kindle 3 coming out at 139 and increasing amount of iPad enthusiasm, we're expecting within the next probably 6 months or so to have about a third of regular book shoppers, who are about 40 million, about 17% of U.S. adults, having some form of digital reading device, whether it's an e-reader or a tablet or something else. And so that's going to drive it in that side. It's going to go much beyond 50%, we believe, because what's happening is, as you take people out of bookstores, they're less viable as a business. I mean, you can see what happened in the music industry. Mm-hmm. Once iTunes and all the other digital music distribution channels got up and running, it just crushed music retailing.
Mm-hmm.
Our office is near Union Square in Manhattan. There was a Virgin Megastore, you know, two blocks from here. It's gone. There's really no major music retailing anymore. So what's going to happen is, it's not just the growth of the devices, it's going to be a rapid decline in book retailing, to the point where bookstores are going to become, you know, seriously endangered.
Hmm.
And so by default, you're going to have to go digital. So I would hazard a guess it's going to go well beyond 50% for that reason.
I was interested in the comparison you made between theaters and bookstores as the place where you you showcase a movie or a book, but it sounds like the theaters are holding on more in the digital age than you expect the bookstores to do. Why is that?
The movie industry has been very, shall we say, street smart in protecting their business. If you go back to the 1950s, you know, television, the death of the movie theater. Well, the movie studio said, no, we're going to have our theatrical release, and the TV channels can, you know, TV show, stations, broadcasters can wait their turn, and we'll give them our content when we're ready. Same thing happened with, you know, VCR. Same thing happened with DVD. They have a strategy that's called windowing, which is in fact invented by book publishers, where every piece of content has different formats and different times and different prices. So with paperback, you know, if you want this read cheap, you can wait a year and you'll get it in paperback. For some reason, the major publishers forgot that, and in, I guess, the blind flurry of, I don't know what, enthusiasm, desperation, I don't know what, agreed to co-release the ebook with the print release. It would be like going into the movie theater lobby and saying, "Hey, why don't you just go home and get a Netflix download right now? You can see this thing for a fraction of the cost of seeing it in the theater." And so the publishers have not tried to protect the business. They've basically given Jeff Bezos the prize of a lifetime.
I think the thing my experience of ebooks, and you know, people who listen to the podcast that I hear from it doesn't seem like I'm that unusual, that when someone, particularly somebody who loves to read, gets a hold of the Kindle and dives deep and experiences all the perceived advantages of reading on it, I haven't purchased a book in probably 2 or 3 years. I think I bought a W.S. Merwin poetry book because I love him and I couldn't find it somewhere.
Right.
But I do love going to movie theaters. And so isn't there a difference that a growing number of people who are using these e-readers are actually coming to prefer reading on that device to the point where if a book comes out that I want and it's not on Kindle, there's really zero chance that I will say, oh, gosh, I can't get it on my Kindle. I'll pay X amount of dollars to buy it in hardcover, because I just don't read that way anymore.
But I think if you made the Harry Potter release that's coming out this Friday available for download on Friday, you wouldn't see a lot of traffic in the movie theaters. It would be down probably 20-30%. That's not sustainable for the distributor chains. And so, you know, they would have the same problem.
Well, I'm not following you. So, in other words, people would...
It doesn't take a lot to, you know, diminish the sales in retail or theaters. So if you have 10% of people saying, I'll skip the print or I'll skip the movie theater experience, you're going to create a lot of pressure on those retail distribution channels. But if the book was available in hardcover and you had to wait 6 months to get it at a cheaper price in digital, I think it would maintain a lot more store traffic and give the book sellers a chance of surviving.
And I suppose the trade-off would be that that would be a way to buttress the bookstores because you wouldn't have that eating into the hardcover sales. The cost would be there would be a lot of money left on the table that you would have otherwise been able to gain from selling ebooks. And you've got
That's actually not true. I mean, if you look at what's, I mean, the best example in terms of the effect of ebook on the marketplace is the Grisham launch. Grisham is the last major author to hold out to not do a co-release. This is the first time he's done a co-released ebook and hardcover. If you look at the combined unit sales of the first week of this book versus his prior book, he gained 3% in units at a 65% discounted cost. So that's really bad economics. You can't take 65% out of the price of a book and only get 3% more in units. That's a rapidly declining revenue stream. See, the thing is, we're not seeing significant revenue growth with ebooks. We're seeing people who are these very sophisticated readers who are Kindle owners reading more units. Yes. They're paying less per unit, and so what that's doing is it's diminishing the total revenue stream of the industry. And then as the retail piece begins to kick in, it's going to really significantly hamper the publisher's revenue stream dramatically. Because, again, it's still 90% of their business.
Right, and you're losing that showcase place, the bookstore, which sort of supports the ability for people to find books.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. The bookstore is the concert hall, the theater, the museum all rolled into one. You know, in music, if you're a professional musician and you don't have the ability to sell your CDs in a Virgin or a Tower Records, no big deal. You're touring anyway. You're doing concerts, so that's how you make your money. You don't need that to be discovered. If you're a novelist, particularly a debut novelist, somebody who's relatively, you know, in the mid-list, you're not going to get the big publicity. Fiction tends not to get much publicity anyway. That's the world of nonfiction. It doesn't really leave you a lot of other choices to get discovered. The other part of the discovery paradox is that if you look at where those June books were discovered, the largest media on the planet right now is Facebook. So well over a half a billion people, right? The number of new books discovered through Facebook was 0.5%. The number of books discovered through Twitter was less than that. The number of new books through YouTube, a lot of major publishers are doing video trailers and author interview videos, is equally tiny. So all these mega media on the digital side aren't bringing a lot of discovery to the party either. So that's the difficulty, is particularly for novelists, particularly for fiction. We haven't seen the new discovery source that allows those kinds of writers to find an audience as easily, being really defined at this point. You know, hopefully it will, but at least as of what we saw in June, it's a difficult trade-off. And everybody's putting a lot of time into social media marketing, but it doesn't seem to be working as well for books.
Do you think that Kindle was the first to have the ability to highlight a section of a book and put it up on your Twitter and Facebook? I see the new Nook Color is going to have the same thing. Can you imagine that might end up being a new wave for people to spread the word about books that does take advantage of the big social media channels?
I sure hope so. People like to have sample chapters to read. They like to have access to what the book is about. Obviously, you can have that instantly in store. It's a little harder to do digitally. Not every book has look inside features and all the rest of it. So, yeah, it's all to the positive, absolutely. The question is, do you read the text before you understand the message of what the book is? In other words, most people like to know what the book is about before they take the time to read something about it. There has to be that initial kind of bridge to your interests. And if it's not in something that you're interested in, you probably won't take the time. I don't know if you've ever looked at a raw manuscript of a book, you know, just typewritten, you know, it's got a title, you know, what kind of book is it? I don't know what this is. You know, there's this sort of initial sense of, you know, trepidation of, am I going to waste time on something? I don't even know what it is. Whereas, you know, what the publishers usually do pretty well is, okay, here's the book, here's the title. You know, you look at the cover, you look at how it's described, and then you go, okay, that's my kind of book. Now I'll browse a couple of pages.
Yeah.
But there's this kind of reductive process where you start from the big idea, you know, the tweet, the search return line, you know, those 150, 160 characters, whatever, get you engaged, and then you begin to commit some time into investigating it further. So I think people tend to like, I mean, what we do know, people who are 24 and under value the title and the cover of a book much more highly in their book buying decision. Hmm. They're, you know, they're totally digitally wired.
Yeah.
They're used to making very quick decisions based on, you know, image, very short bits of information. And so, you know, it's that short message that I think is increasingly how people come to books and connect. So the more you do that, the better.
Well, I know if you got to go, the tipping point comment you made in the Times a couple of days ago, saying this is the tipping point season. And are you pessimistic that this, from what you've said, I can imagine that you're not thinking this is the greatest tipping point that civilization has gone through.
No, it really scares the hell out of me. One, for fiction. We do pro bono work for the National Endowment for the Arts on literacy. And so right now, about 110, I think, million U.S. adults have read a book in the last 12 months. Mm-hmm. So about half of U.S. adults have read a book. We, as a country, don't score that well in terms of literacy relative to other first world countries. So we're kind of mediocre in that world already. You look at the percent of people who buy books, about 40 million, about 17%. If all of a sudden the only way you can access a book is by owning a device, what happens to people who don't have the wherewithal, the interest, the money to go buy a device just to have access to a book? So, you know, if you fast forward, you know, 10 years from now, if print is hugely diminished and you just have print on demand and things like that, what happens to, you know, the kid who's in an underprivileged situation who won't be exposed to a book, won't have access to one of these devices? It just, to me, you know, there's that fear that you create a two-caste society of those who have access to books because they can afford all the electronics that go with it, and those that don't get exposed to it as readily. So that to me is the real concern. You know, music, fine, everybody's got an iPod, no big deal. Does it affect our ability to perform as a country? Does it affect our economy? No. But if we have a country that's less than literate, that has a direct, and the National Endowment for the Arts has done research on that. Mm. It correlates critical reading ability to economic performance, and so both individually and as a country. And so the question is, you know, how does that serve us overall? So there's really a public policy issue in all this. So we're not seeing more people reading. We're seeing heavy readers reading more. We're not seeing increased revenue for publishers, which means authors have less of an ability to make a living. And there was a great article, I think, about 2 months ago in the Wall Street Journal on this. With the new royalty rates for digital, the authors make about $1 less per unit sold. So there's a lot of things that are kind of ugly as you've put this fully in place. And
well, this is good.
It's a major sea change.
The plan for the third anniversary of the Kindle was to have someone from Amazon come and talk about what a wonderful 3 years. And so you've been a good contrarian voice to cast. So at least raise at least some questions.
It's absolutely fabulous for Amazon. I mean, they've got the last man standing. You know, the thing that gets really impressive, and I give Jeff Bezos huge credit for this. You know, 90% of U.S. households have a DVD player, right? Does that mean the movie theaters go away? No. The studios say, no, we're going to protect this. We're going to protect the theaters. They had the biggest box office year in history last year, with about less than 1% of U.S. adults having a Kindle. He managed to convince all the major publishers that they had to completely change their business model to defer to Amazon, which they've done. They've completely fallen in line with, you know, less than 1% of U.S. Households owning these devices. And he will be, you know, not the only last man standing. He will, you know, get massive market share gains as this thing unfolds over the next, you know, 1 to 2 years. So no, hats off to Jeff Bezos. I mean, he's played a masterful game here, and Amazon comes out of this thing, you know, with just, you know, phenomenal opportunity. But it's the authors and all the other things we talked about who won't fare so well on this. The long tail just gets a lot longer. Mm-hmm.
Well, this has been fascinating. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about it. And I hope you're wrong. I hope that there's some way that new authors find a way to be found in this new world. And,
yeah, I mean, that's the challenge. How do you solve for that? Because it's not apparent at this point.
Well, if we can grow the audience for my podcast, I'll do my best.
Well, good luck with it.
All right. Thanks a lot. Good to talk to Peter.
Absolutely.
Bye. Peter and I had some email exchanges after our interview, and one point that he brought to my attention is that the George Bush memoir Decision Points sold 14% of its units in ebook in its first week, according to Publishers Weekly, and that was half of what the Grisham book did as a percentage, the one that he talked about. And that's in line with what publishers are telling him about nonfiction not doing quite as well on the Kindle. His points about how people discover books I found provocative. I hadn't really considered that part of it. You know, sometimes you can make some mistakes just drawing generalities from your own experience. And I think what gives his opinion some weight is the obvious extent of the research he's doing, 7,000, 6,000 people at a time, doing some pretty precise measurement of how people are finding books. So, you know, obviously I'm a little more optimistic about the direction that ebooks are taking us. And also I think we didn't really get a chance to talk about the extent of the self-publishing area and how that's offering opportunities to authors, probably modest at this point, but with some potential for growth. I'd be curious if you think that you are considering or discovering a narrower range of books as a Kindle reader than you did when you were a frequenter of bookstores and reading print books. This is kind of the key point that Peter was raising. And if you'd like to send me an email with your observations of your own habits on this point, I'd be interested to hear about it. You could send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. In content, I want to mention that a listener named Mark sent me a list of 383 authors that he compiled from the Great Books and the Harvard Books list. And it's a handy list, all organized in chronological order. So it's a good guide if you want to create a Kindle library. Certainly a lot of the older authors are available in the public domain, and so it's a good guide for building a very comprehensive library of classics. I also want to mention a video review, which was done by Nick Todd, and he sent me a link, which I'll include in the show notes. He was reviewing a book that's it's a true story of an espionage case that's fascinating from World War II. The title of the book is Operation Mincemeat. It's a video review, and it's interesting because his critique of the book is mainly the use of the photos and how you can't zoom in and see some of these interesting photos that are in the book because the zoom pages are all one page and you've got three photos on it. A valuable service that he provided to make this evident to those of us that are reading Kindle books and to get a peek into a book to see exactly what it looks like is useful. So appreciate Nick Todd passing along that video review, and check it out if you've got any interest in a good non. It's got fabulous reviews. It's got 45 five-star reviews, and I've read about this book before. It's a pretty compelling tale. And finally, I received a comment from Kate Harper on why she returned the Kindle 3 that she purchased. She's still got her Kindle 2. The problem was how to hold the Kindle 3 and turn the pages without having wrist pain. And that's because the Kindle 3, the buttons are a little bit more on the side than on the front or the top of the Kindle, which is the case with the Kindle 2. She writes, "I think the big mistake on the 3 is they shouldn't have made it smaller, but rather just added new features." And she was sad to return it, thinks that the Kindle 4, when it comes, it would be good to go back to the Kindle 2 size, which she thinks is the perfect book size. Smaller is not always better, Kate wrote. I don't think you're alone in having those issues, but I think that the smaller size really was a huge advantage, so I tend to think that the trade-offs were made pretty well. But that's an interesting point. I appreciate you sending me that comment. That's it for my return to live podcasting here. I hope you've enjoyed the show. One show I know is coming up next is I received invitations to have three young readers to follow up Stephen's comments. So I'll look forward to that and then catch up with my Amazon executive. Music for my podcast is Ramonk by Yval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD. This is Len Edgerly in Cambridge, Massachusetts for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.